Is tolerance the best we can hope for in gay civil rights?
I think we do tend to think that tolerance is a great thing, and certainly compared to intolerance or violence, it is good. But tolerance is a word that has a more problematic history. We usually speak of tolerating something that we would rather do without.
That's Susanna Danuta Walters. Her groundbreaking new book is The Tolerance Trap: How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. And a new report from Human Rights Watch says government spying is threatening the rights of journalists and their public, as well as lawyers and their clients.
The rights that really stand out here are freedom of expression, the right to counsel, the right of the public to know what its government is doing.
That's Alex Sinha. He's the author of the report, With Liberty to Monitor All. And that's all on the docket today on Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We like to think that tolerance is a good thing. It's the word we use to denote respect for diversity in such issues as race, gender, and sexual orientation. Tolerance for gays and acceptance of homosexuality has become mainstream. But my guest, Susanna Danuta Walters, doesn't think tolerance is all it's cracked up to be. In her new book, The Tolerance Trap, she says the notion of tolerance actually undermines true integration of gays into the larger society. And she thinks marriage equality, while an undeniable human right, is a kind of Trojan horse because it turns the fight for gay civil rights away from more important issues. Susanna Danuta Walters is the director of Women's, Gender, and Sexuality Studies and professor of sociology at Northeastern University. She's the author of several books, including All the Rage, The Story of Gay Visibility in America, and Material Girls, Making Sense of Feminist Cultural Theory. We talked about her new book, The Tolerance Trap, in June. Susanna Danuta Walters, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
The Tolerance Trap takes a number of very controversial positions, and I'd like to really start just with the, first of all, the definition of tolerance. What are some of the problematic issues around this term?
Well, I think we do tend to think that tolerance is a great thing, and certainly compared to intolerance or violence, it is good. But tolerance is a word that has a more problematic history. We usually speak of tolerating something that we would rather do without. We tolerate a boring movie. We tolerate, a rainy day. We tolerate, a long, endless meeting. We don't usually speak of tolerating that which we love. We don't speak of tolerating great sex, or tolerating a good book. So toleration and tolerance is really implies in its very language that there's something wrong or bad to be tolerated. If there's not a problem, there's nothing to tolerate. So there is an implication with tolerance to say, well, I tolerate, we're tolerant of homosexuality. You're in some way saying there's something wrong with this, but we're a civilized society now, so we'll be tolerant. And acceptance is very similar in that regard. We accept that. Accept is not the same as an embrace. Accept is not the same as celebration. And I think that this is a moment in history and in the gay rights movement where we really have settled on this language of tolerance and acceptance and need to re-embrace a language of embrace and celebration.
And what would embrace and celebration mean in terms of a larger society? What does that look like? And, is there anything in between tolerance and acceptance on the one hand and celebration on the other? In other words, is there a continuum one can move along where there is a kind of, qualitative change that comes to true integration?
Well, that's the tough question. I mean, I think a lot of people think tolerance is a stepping stone, that you start out with being more tolerant and then you get to real integration and liberation. I actually think tolerance undermines the potential for real liberation and integration. And when you ask sort of what is the other thing look like? I mean, You know, the best example I can give is thinking back towards in the civil rights movement and the questions around integration. Now, we argued for integration of institutions, not simply because it was the ethical and right thing to do, and of course, then the legal thing to do, but because those institutions and places and homes and families and communities became themselves transformed when they were integrated. Robust integration means not just that you're letting someone in the door, but that once someone's in the door, they change the very contours of that room that they're in. They change everybody. Tolerance doesn't change the people who are doing the tolerated. They're in that position of power still. It's a very different language than really robust integration, where we talk about the positive benefits of transforming, of integrating differences into whatever environment it is. I mean, I work at a university, and I know that when we argue for more diverse faculty, for example, we don't do it just because it's the right thing to do and because it looks better on paper. We do it because those places are made richer because of it. We are made better people because of it. We are a better society because of it. Tolerance has nothing to do with that.
Susanna Walters, in your book, The Tolerance Trap, you go into some of the history of just the incredibly swift change in attitudes towards gayness in the society. And you start out some of that by talking about your own experience. And I'd like to ask you to read a section from this about your own experience, and then we can talk about how it illuminates where we've come from. So it starts on page 19.
Back in the day, this was how it went. You sidled or ambled or strode into the gay bar. You were nervous but so very excited to be there. You found this bar maybe through the one gay bookstore in town. Leaflets pointed the way. Maybe you found it through those early cheesy guidebooks that you could buy at those precious bookstores, or through the mail, wrapped ever so discreetly in generic brown paper. Maybe you just knew, and you'd go up to the bar and order a drink. If you were me, underage and clearly looking it, you ordered that beer nervously, and probably a bit too loudly, never making eye contact with the bartender. You would sit and sip that beer and look around, trying not to seem too new, too obviously inept and green. And finally, after what seemed like a lifetime, she would come and sit next to you. If you were like me, young, she would probably be older by at least a dozen years, and she would bring you out. Years later, or maybe years earlier, you would tell your parents, or maybe not. And it would go surprisingly well, although everyone squirmed and looked at their feet. Or it didn't go well at all, and you were called names and told to leave. And there were tears and slaps, or laughter, or disgust and blame apportioned, probably to your mother. And you might tell friends, regale them with a story that you knew you were making as you spoke it, a story that imposed a revelatory plot line, even as you felt a bit uncomfortable with that linearity. You might, like me, speak it loudly and angrily, trying so hard not to look scared, to schoolmates in high school, and watch those schoolmates shift uncomfortably in their seats and never really hang out with you anymore. You might fear reprisal or rejection, and you just might get it. But you might also feel that you just couldn't live if you didn't tell. Tell this story. Your story, but not yours alone, which is what sometimes made it not only livable but thrilling. It was our pickup line, our Bildungsroman, our coming of age, our grand narrative, or so we thought. It was told in smoke-filled bars and in therapist offices and in tears in the college dormitory. It was told to lovers old and new and to family biological and constructed. It was most easily told to strangers. It was our origin story, but also our grand finale. And like all melodramas, it was as obfuscating and narrow and riddled with contradictions as such stories inevitably are.
That's a wonderful passage. So now tell us a little bit about in the story of you coming out. Your mother was a family therapist, certainly progressive. What was her reaction when you told her that you were gay?
Well, it was a very funny story, because it was one of these situations where you leave every hint around possible. And remember, this was the, mid-late 70s. And, you know, it just wasn't in public discourse in the same way, of course, that it is now. There were no such thing as gay support groups, really. There was certainly nothing in high schools, and GLSEN didn't exist. And all the kinds of gay-straight alliances in schools just were not there at all. So it was a very different time. And I had a wonderfully progressive family, and my mother's first reaction was simply, no, you're not. And, you know, what's interesting about the story with her is that, you know, she really did come around. And she came around because she saw it politically as a social movement. I mean, she was a longtime feminist and active in the civil rights movement. So for her, this became linked up with that. It wasn't just, I love my daughter, so I'm going to, you know, learn to have some better answers to these issues. But it was because she began to see it in terms of social justice. Mm-hmm. But again, one of the things, you know, when I tell this story and when I wrote this story, you know, it is one of those moments when you realize, boy, how times have changed. And they really have changed enormously. I think some of that sense of real isolation and aloneness that kids of my generation felt, and certainly of previous generations, that sense of invisibility has changed. I mean, there are representations on television, in film, in public office, in advertising, and that is enormously empowering. And, you know, I couldn't have dreamed this day would exist. That being said, it's not changed enough. And kids are still being kicked out of their homes and still feel shame and still feel some isolation and still are disproportionately in the homeless population, gay youth, disproportionately suicidal. And hate crimes still exist and, in fact, have been growing in recent years, particularly in New York, of all places. So, you know, the idea, the storyline that, you know, my story is a thing irrevocably of the past and could only exist in that historical moment, I think is a fiction. It is still, for so many in so many places in this country and abroad, a struggle to come out. And it's a struggle to come out because the ideologies of, you know, anti-gay hatred and animus and bigotry are still with us, even though so much has changed.
Yes, you talk a lot in The Tolerance Trap, Susanna Walters, you talk a lot about how marriage equality has become part of that trap. You call it a Trojan horse, actually. I wonder if you could say why, and I think it's a fascinating argument because it calls into examination the ways in which what we do around gay rights also says a lot about what we do around gender rights. So let's go back to, why is it a Trojan horse?
Well, I should say, first off, of course, that as a civil rights issue, it's a no-brainer, as far as I'm concerned. And I want to celebrate the people who have worked for this, and I recognize it as a victory. I mean, when DOMA went down in the Supreme Court, last year, I was screaming and crying with everybody else. It is an incredible victory. And in fact, the pace of it has been astounding. The numbers of states just keep racking up. It is an important victory. Now, that being said, there are a number of issues here. One that I find probably the most troubling is the way in which a movement has gotten associated with one particular social right and civic right. So if you go on Google and, you know, any search engine and type in gay rights, what you're going to get is gay marriage. The slippage between the two has become so strong at this point that we absolutely believe, I think, in mainstream culture, that gay rights and gay marriage are synonymous. They're the same thing. We get gay marriage and we've won it. We can pack up our tutus and go home. The battle for gay rights has been won. And I think that's a terrible error. No social movement worth its salt has so banked on winning one simple civil right as the be-all and end-all of that movement. Women's movement didn't do it. I mean, abortion rights, pay equity, violence against women, changes in gender consciousness, equality in terms of domestic labor. You can go down the list. They've all been vibrant parts of the women's movement. civil rights movement wasn't just about equality in education or integration in schools and in neighborhoods. It was about challenging racism in every aspect of society. So I think to the extent that the gay movement has sort of allowed and maybe even promulgated an idea that gay marriage, marriage equality, is the brass ring, it is a mistake and a danger. There's also, of course, another part of this, which I think you alluded to in your questions, which is, you know, what is this actual institution that we're asking to be a part of? There's been a robust critique of marriage and of gay marriage and straight marriage from feminists, from progressive activists for years, a robust and interesting debate on a number of lines. You know, one line being, why are we asking to gain entry into an institution that has been built on the historically on the ownership of women and children? Why is this the institution that we're wanting to gain access to? Why are social rights and benefits, including health care and citizenship and inheritance and social security, based on one particular form of intimacy? So I think for many progressives, and particularly feminist progressives, we would like to see a disentanglement of benefits and rights, particularly around health care and inheritance rights, taken away from a particular form of intimacy. So there's a fear that there's going to now be created even more of a hierarchy between those good gays, you know, who get married, who want nothing more than marriage and the military as their, you know, as their signs of equality, and then the rest of us who, you know, who argue for gender equity, for sexual freedom, who don't want to be married for any set of reasons. People should be able to get married if they want to. No question about it. But to treat it as the sign of all things liberatory, as the sign of gay freedom, is patently ridiculous as far as I'm concerned.
You mentioned before the military. I have wondered, and I did wonder, because it seems to me that the fight to allow gays into the military, it was the first one, and then the marriage equality came right after it. I wondered for a long time, why are these the banners of the gay rights movement? I'd like to ask you why. Why those two issues? Why were they the engine of the gay rights movement?
Well, they weren't always. I mean, that should be said. I mean, you look back on the days, you know, both pre-Stonewall and during the Stonewall years and the Gay Liberation Front. And, you know, it was about sexual freedom and about, you know, challenging kinship notions and gender and, you know, all of that stuff, right? So it wasn't always this way. I think we should say that. I think there's a way in which we look at particularly marriage now. We say, oh, this has always been, you know, the desire for gays. This has been our, you know, our brass ring. Not really. For most of us and for most of the history of the gay rights movement, marriage was not on the radar as either something we could get or something we wanted to get as a central issue. Now, you know, that being said, you know, both of these issues, I think, became, and it's a very good question of how they became so central. And so long, you know, I couldn't answer it completely. But I think one of the reasons is that they are so patently obvious forms of discrimination. I mean, here are central institutions, for better or for worse, of American culture, the military and marriage. And, you know, they are wrapped, both of them wrapped in the flag, both of them wrapped in ideologies of romance, of citizenship, of nation, and they were patently exclusionary. So I think part of the reason is it's an easy case to make. I also think they're kind of easy ones for straight allies to get behind, because it's wrapped in these ideologies of romance, of love. Everybody understands that, you know, patriotism. Everybody understands that all gays want to do is fight for their country, and all gays want to do is get married just like you. So it allows, I think, straights to embrace to a certain extent gay rights in an easy way that doesn't challenge them. Because they're saying, you have this right, I want a piece of that. Instead of saying, we actually want to challenge the centrality of these institutions.
They've also been issues, particularly I'd say the marriage equality, that have occasioned some pretty strange bedfellows. I do find it interesting that you have folks like right. Paul Singer and David Koch. Paul Singer, the hedge fund manager, David Koch, people who are on the extreme right-wing libertarian end of politics, who have been making common ground with, you know, Democratic politicians, and that even Democratic politicians who are, say, not so robust in their support of abortion rights, but are much more are support in marriage equality. Why has marriage equality become the darling of the political establishment, and what has been the effect of that on the larger political conversation?
Oh, it's a great question. Yeah, when I saw that Paul Singer started this sort of super PAC for right-wingers to support gay marriage, I got even more scared than I already was about the marriage movement. You know, I mean, what's true is there's always strange bedfellows in politics, so there is a certain way you have to accept some of that. But I do think, in many ways, rightly so, these conservatives recognize marriage as a conservative institution. And there has been an argument, both from some gay leaders and, of course, from these conservative libertarians, there has been an argument that, you know, let's have gays get married because then we can tame them. You know, we can tame the wild excesses of sexuality, corral it, bring it into the rubric of the sort of marriage and the state, because marriage is, after all, a state-monitored, commodified institution of gender norms. So let's bring them into that and in some ways dethrone and push aside the radical edges of gender challenge and sexuality challenge that's been part of the gay rights movement. You know, that's why it's the Trojan horse in that way. I mean, it is, you know, an issue that liberals can get behind. It's an issue that, you know, some conservatives can get behind because, oh, here's my, you know, it's just fairness and equality and everyone wants to be married. Why should we deny this central social institution to, you know, gays and lesbians? And it doesn't say anything about the debates around sexuality, about gender norms, about, you know, sexual freedom. It allows all of that to be pushed to the side. And in fact, if you look at much of the argumentation that gay rights activists have made in a lot of these cases, you know, a lot of the language our side uses is a language of sameness and a language of all we want is what you want. All we want is to do just what you do. We want to be able to raise our children just like you do, to which I would respond, where's the gay and the gay marriage in that, you know? I mean, there is another more radical argument for same-sex marriage that one could make, which is that, in fact, difference matters, that one could make an argument that gay marriages might, in fact, alter the way we think about family and sexuality and intimacy. In other words, if marriage has been based on heterosexuality, on the division of labor in the household between male and female, on gender norms and gender roles, what happens when that gender difference is removed from the equation of the marital institution? You know, there is a more radical argument to be made, but most gay activists and lawyers and folks arguing for this say, you know, we want this because we just want to be like you.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Susanna Danuta Walters about her book, The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. Now, you mentioned we want to have children just like you. You chose to become the single parent. You chose to become a single mother at a point where there were still a lot of approbation of gay parents. I wonder if you could talk about what making that choice was like, and what was it like in a culture in which single mothers are put down, much less gay single mothers?
Yeah, it's true. It was sort of a double whammy there. But yes, I mean, I you know, I have a wonderful 19-year-old daughter who I absolutely adore. And you know what? What's interesting to me, actually, and, you know, given what we were just talking about the questions of family, is in a lot of the gay marriage court cases and debates, as you know, questions of kids come up all the time. The anti-gay marriage side argues, you know, isn't this going to be terrible for children and gay people can't raise children and they need to be raised by two heterosexual parents, blah, blah, blah. Now, the response has been, by and large, from our side, from the gay rights side, has been to say, social science shows us that, you know, kids do no worse. Kids of gay parents do no worse than kids of heterosexual parents. There's no difference. To which I want to reply something quite different, which is to say they should be different. We should make the positive argument. In other words, kids of gay parents, one would imagine, would actually have broader, deeper, more expansive notions of gender and sexuality. You know, difference matters. that isn't recognizing the kinds of ways of building queer kinships that are really different and that should have a positive effect on all of us. Again, not just on those particular kids, but on the way heterosexuals think of family. Look, we still live in a society in which, by and large, most of the childcare is done by women, where women do a second shift and do most of the labor in the home. And those are the kids growing up in those families seeing that gender division of labor. What happens when the world in a family home is not divided by gender? Those kids should have more expansive and open ideas about gender and sexuality.
And how was that for your daughter growing up? How do you see the evolution of her understanding of gender and gender roles and sexuality?
Well, I do think she is she's a feminist, of course, and I think she is. She's a very gay positive kid. I think she has a much more open, and part of that is just generational, because we do know that this, younger generations are, more and more open to sexual fluidity and gender fluidity. And, in terms of gay rights issues, much, better than older generations by and large in most of the polling we see. But I do think it has mattered that she was raised in this different kind of family, so that when she thinks of forming a family, if she thinks of having children, of raising a family, she has a different model to work from. Not only am I a single parent, but I've created a family network that is not biological. So my daughter has all kinds of women and men in her life that are figures of support and sustenance that aren't wedded to a nuclear family model. So I think that's been a very positive effect on her.
Susanna Danuta Walters. We'll talk more about her book, The Tolerance Trap, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking about the movement for gay rights in the U.S. and how that movement has become narrowed in scope at the same time that it has gained an acceptance by the larger culture. Susanna Danuta Walters is our guest. Her book is The Tolerance Trap: How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. As per the subtitle, one of the issues she looks at is the notion that people are born gay, that it's not a chosen lifestyle, as anti-gay conservatives claim. While rejecting the conservative view, Walters isn't comfortable with the born gay thesis either. I asked her why.
It actually is interesting because it didn't start out being such a central part of the book, but it became a very major part of my book because I found it everywhere. It was, the definition of a dominant ideology. I could not escape the born with it ideology, from Lady Gaga, all the way through court cases, legal argumentation, political pundits, mainstream film and television. It has become the way good liberals who support gay rights are supposed to think. You are supposed to think that you're born with it. Now, there's a number of issues here. Number one, the science on sexual orientation is very thin science. It's been debunked in the same way on the science of gender differences has been debunked. The idea that there's some hardwired, innate differences in men's brains and women's brains and, gay and straight has been widely critiqued. But I guess I would say, more to the point, even if that weren't the case, even if the science were great, robust science, that it's the wrong question to ask when we're talking about civil rights. One should not ask for your rights based on biologically determinist notions. No social movement has ever done this. Give me my rights because, I can't help myself because I have a compulsion. Give me my rights, because this is biologically imprinted. In fact, quite the opposite. If you have any glancing knowledge of history, you know that biologically innate and immutable arguments have been used by and large for oppression, for genocide. The history of the Holocaust, of course, is One example, the history of slavery and apartheid is another example, and the history of misogyny is another example, where biological arguments about the innate differences and inferiority of women have been used as arguments for oppression and exclusion. So the idea that now we're at this moment where gays are making an argument for inclusion and rights on the basis of biological immutability chills my very soul. It is the wrong question to ask. It doesn't matter how we got there. It doesn't matter how we experience it. People experience their sexuality in a variety of ways. Some people feel, I've always had this. Some people change over the life course. People come to their sexuality in a wide variety of ways. It doesn't matter how you come there. The question is, are you a human being and are you deserving of civil rights? It's not based on biology. So I'm really disturbed at how that has become such a core aspect of the way in which we understand civil rights for gays at this moment. It has just permeated every aspect of our culture.
And yet that's happened in order to counter the right-wing propaganda that, you know, this is a choice, this is the gay lifestyle, and that this is going as a choice of a gay lifestyle. It's part of a gay agenda to contaminate sexuality in America.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think in some ways, even people who don't believe it, you know, who are smart enough to say, oh God, the idea that sexuality is hardwired is kind of silly. It's a little more complicated than that. I think a lot of people do use it strategically, because it does counter these ideas of contagion. But I tell you, we've gotten to a bad place when progressives cede the idea of choice to the right wing. And I understand the strategic importance. I do understand why people do it. But I think it is a very dangerous road to go down. Because, of course, you should know that no one's doing a lot of research on looking for the straight gene. Right? I mean, people are looking for that which they want, they already think is a problem, and that which they want to cure. The idea that you're looking for a cause of sexuality, and you're not, you're looking for a cause of homosexuality, should tell us a lot about the politics of this research.
And so you're actually saying that this could actually be dangerous because we could come into an era where people who are seen as genetically being homosexuality could be subject to a policy of extermination. I mean, like in the Holocaust.
Look, I wouldn't put it past us. You know, we've had eugenicist policies in the past. Mm-hmm. We've gone from moments of measuring people's brains and say they're, you know, inferior. You know, we know the history of that. So it is not impossible to imagine that people will say, oh, we found that gene. Let's see if we can cure it.
So as much as we do celebrate advances in civil rights of gays, and it's clear from this conversation we have much more to go, what do you see as the end game? What are the legal advances that still remain to be made to ensure true gay equality?
Well, I wish I knew the complete answer to that, but I have some thoughts. You know, I do think that we still have a long way to go on basic questions of civil rights. We still can't pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. I mean, that just drives me nuts. It's been introduced since the 90s. And we, you know, so it's still legal to fire people on the basis of their sexuality. We've got to pass ENDA. You know, we've got to deal with the continued reality of anti-gay violence. From the most, you know, the more benign forms of epithets in the schoolyard to bashings and murders and tortures, which still go on. We've got to deal with the fact that it is still very hard for people to come out, that gay youth are still discriminated against in home, kicked out of their homes. Those are all real social issues that need to be wrestled with still. But then there's also the question of consciousness. And I do think that we need to reignite the relationship between the gay rights movement and the feminist movement. I mean, to me, that's got to be a core. I mean, I was saying to some friends the other day, you know, when I see everybody who's out there, and particularly all the men who are out there working so hard for marriage equality, I want to say, when you guys start defending women's right to choose and start defending those clinics, then I'll believe that this is a more genuine commitment to equality and not just about getting benefits for a few through marriage rights. So I do think we need to relink the gay rights movement to broader agendas for progressive social change, whether it's immigration rights, whether it's prison reform and prison abolition movement, you know, whether it's through economic equity, and particularly, of course, around gender fluidity and gender equity. You know, we need to make those links stronger again and not just keep the bar so low in asking for tolerance and acceptance. If you ask for tolerance, that's all you'll get. We need to go back to those notions of gay pride and gay liberation and gay sexual freedom that pushes all of us to reimagine our sexualities, our kinship constructions, our communities in more open and diverse ways.
So I just want to ask you to trace out a little bit more in detail, why are those notions of gay pride connected to issues of reproductive rights, of the whole larger issue of oppression and the construction of masculinity, let's say, in this culture?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, what is homophobia? What is anti-gay hatred? It's hatred towards those who enact their gender and sexual identities at odds with our normative ideas of gender and sexuality. Women who aren't dependent on men. You know, what is the biggest insult, you know, that was thrown at feminists all the time, right? In the early days of feminism, oh, you dyke, right? Which meant that you're not attached to a man. You're bucking the ideas of normative femininity, of, you know, what is it to say to gay men? What is the, you know, the biggest slurs to say, you know, about gay men? That they're not really men. They're not macho. They're effeminate. It is, you know, it is that they're not masculinity that becomes that which needs to be exterminated, which needs to be snuffed out, which needs to be mocked. So the links between normative ideas of gender and sexuality and, you know, both homophobia and sexism are profound. I mean, in my mind, you cannot have a gay rights movement worth its salt that is not simultaneously feminist. And some of our leaders work at this differently. Groups like the gay, you know, the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force. The task force is a group that's a much more broadly based progressive organization that works around economic equity, that works around racism and the intersections of gender, race, class, sexuality. You know, other groups, you know, like the Human Rights Campaign, I think maybe not so much. They tend to be more corporatist, to have those strange bedfellows that we were talking about earlier. So I do think, you know, I'm certainly of that school of, you know, intersectional thought that really believes we need to, you know, have much stronger alliances and connections with progressive social movements, not just because it's strategically the right thing to do, but because these things are actually linked in people's consciousness.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Susanna Danuta Walters, your book is The Tolerance Trap, How God, Genes, and Good Intentions Are Sabotaging Gay Equality. Thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Susanna Danuta Walters teaches and writes about gay rights and gender issues at Northeastern University. Next up, we talk with Alex Sinha of Human Rights Watch about the impact of government spying on journalists and lawyers. It's been a year since Edward Snowden blew the lid off NSA spying, and as the reporting on his revelations has continued, it's become clear that Big Brother has arrived with a vengeance. As journalist Glenn Greenwald shows in his recent book, No Place to Hide, virtually all electronic communications of Americans are collected by the government. Now, Human Rights Watch and the ACLU have come out with a joint report with Liberty to Monitor All. It looks at the harmful impact government spying on the one hand and government secrecy on the other are having on two professions critical to democracy, journalism and the legal profession. My guest, Alex Sinha of Human Rights Watch, wrote the report. I started out by asking him, what are the human rights implications of government spying and secrecy?
I guess the rights that really stand out here are freedom of expression, the right to counsel, the right of the public to know what its government is doing.
The report puts the situation in the context of both government secrecy and the crackdown on leaks, as well as the surveillance. So secrecy on the one hand on the part of the government and erosion of privacy on the part of the public. Sketch out what's been going on and briefly how it's developed.
This administration has been very aggressive in prosecuting and cracking down on leaks. It's known among journalists to have pursued more prosecutions of accused leakers than all previous administrations combined. They've done 8 such prosecutions, or at least have attempted 8 such prosecutions, and all previous administrations put together total up to 3. So right off the bat, you have what seems to be, at least to a number of journalists, an attitude of cracking down on leaks. And then in 2011, probably in response to the Manning leak, the government instituted a program called the Insider Threat Program. And that program basically requires federal agencies to monitor employees carefully and to set up a system so that employees, federal officials, can inform on one another if they suspect each other of acting suspiciously in ways that might betray an intention to leak information to the press. And there are other smaller policies like that. The intelligence community has passed some recent rules, too, that ban unauthorized contact with the press and require certain other details. If you bump into a reporter, you have to report it to your boss and so forth. So there's a context here that's been building over the last few years that really shows to journalists and to sources that the government does not want them having contact that isn't regulated by, talking points or some straightforward press office guidelines.
One can understand why government might want to control the release of certain classified information and, legitimately claim national security. But you say that the reach is overbroad and that things are being overclassified.
Yes. And none of the journalists disagreed with the characterization you just made either. I mean, everybody realizes that the U.S. government is supposed to protect national security. And that may mean protecting certain information, the release of which could threaten national security. And most of the journalists I spoke with are very responsible about that. They realize that they can sometimes get their hands on information that they probably shouldn't release and they won't release. But the government itself acknowledges that it overclassifies information. In 2012 alone, there were something like 95 million decisions to classify or reclassify information inside the federal government. And the government has taken steps that haven't amounted to much, but has attempted, and in doing so has acknowledged that it overclassifies information. But in a way, the scariest part of all of this, I think, is that because officials are worried about the insider threat program or about prosecutions and about generally being linked to reporters, they don't want to talk about anything. They don't want to talk about unclassified things, even things that the government itself, in this mode of overclassifying, won't classify. Those things they won't talk about either. They won't wave you off a story. They won't confirm unclassified details or share an opinion. And some of those things are very much a matter of public concern and certainly not the sorts of things that the government has a right to keep from the public.
When Obama took office, he said this was going to be the most transparent administration ever. What you've just sketched out belies that claim. What are some examples that you can give of when unclassified information has been deemed to be a threat or people are too afraid? What are some of the risks where people are too afraid to release even unclassified information?
Well, I think the risk to sources, the way they perceive it, is that if they get linked to a reporter and their boss wants to know why they were talking to a reporter, they can be investigated, they can be suspected of leaking, they can be suspected of leaking more than they did, and they can lose their security clearance, they can be fired, they can be investigated by the Department of Justice, they can be prosecuted. A number of the accused leakers have incurred massive, massive financial costs trying to defend themselves. So the range of penalties is pretty severe. In D.C., if you lose your security clearance, that's that's it. I mean, that can be the end of your career. And so, you know, I have heard stories. I heard a story from one journalist who said that his outlet had developed this source inside the government over the course of a year. They had a very sort of deliberate process building this relationship, and after about a year, they ran a story using some information provided by this source. The information was not classified. And apparently when the story ran, the agency that employed the source tried to figure out who had provided the information, and they managed to track back the relationship over the course of a year and figure out who the source was and fire that person. And this is, again, over something that's not classified. So it's these kinds of stories that are really frightening, you know, to sources and really make journalists feel that they have to take new steps to protect their sources.
And tell us a little bit about Thomas Drake as an example of this. I mean, this guy was not really revealing secrets. It's more like he was revealing what could be an embarrassment to the government because he was revealing waste, fraud, and abuse.
Yeah, the Drake case is one of the ones that really, I think, rubs a lot of journalists the wrong way, because in the end, after charging him heavily and, you know, forcing him to prepare for trial, right before the trial, the government dropped most of its charges against him in exchange for a very, very minor misdemeanor plea, something about misusing a computer or something like that. And even the judge came down very harshly on the government, on the prosecution, for the way they had put him through the ringer, ultimately just to drop the charges. And like you said, what he was trying to reveal there was how the NSA was spending a huge amount of money on a system that he thought was not working. He thought it was a misuse of money. It was not operational details of, you know, a surveillance program the way that we might be talking about with a Snowden-type leak. So that is a kind of a prime example of why people are worried under the current administration. I should add that I believe that investigation, that prosecution, was inherited from the Bush administration, the prosecution of Thomas Drake, but the current administration did pursue it pretty forcefully to the end.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Alex Sinha, author of a new report from Human Rights Watch, with liberty to monitor all. Soon after Snowden revealed the scope of NSA spying on Americans, Obama claimed that the government wasn't, quote, listening in on your phone calls. At that point, it was thought that the NSA was collecting only so-called metadata of emails and phone calls, but not their content. In fact, it turns out they are collecting your content. But metadata is important, too. I asked Alex Sinha to explain.
For journalists, the major worry is just the metadata alone, because if the government doesn't want a source to talk to a journalist, all they need to know is that the source is talking to a journalist in order to become suspicious or to become upset about it. And the metadata do reveal who you're in communication with, even if they don't reveal what you've said. And so if the government wants to find out who is talking to journalist X and they manage to acquire records of that, whether through surveillance or otherwise, they'll know just from the metadata alone that the source was talking to journalist X, and that can be enough for them to start investigating and pressing and suspecting the person of doing something wrong.
Alex Sinha, in this report, with liberty to monitor all, this report that you did for Human Rights Watch, you say that this is changing journalistic practices. How are journalists changing the way they function, the way they work, in order to continue to do their job, basically, without undue interference?
Yeah, this might in some ways be the most interesting part of the report. There is such a strange range of activities that journalists feel the need to engage in to protect their sources. The range is huge, and the number of different responses I've heard really reflects the uncertainty about what information gets collected and how it gets used and so forth. So you have some journalists who are very tech savvy, and they're starting to use burner cell phones, you know, disposable cell phones that are prepaid and bought with cash and not registered in their names. You have journalists using air-gapped computers, which are just, they're computers that don't connect to networks like the internet, because that keeps them more secure. you have journalists using encryption, a lot of encryption for email, for chat, maybe even for calls. So there are things like that on the heavy tech side. And then you have people who are trying to use the tools they conventionally have in more creative ways, you know, trying to call sources from friends' houses or use their email accounts in creative ways. And some of those steps may not be very effective. I think the single biggest trend that I would say, aside from trying to use more encryption and burner phones, is using less technology altogether. So many journalists think that the best thing to do is to try and meet your source and speak to him or her face to face. And the hardest part about doing that, aside from the fact that it takes more time, is setting up a meeting with a source without leaving an electronic trail. Because in order to do that, normally you would call someone or you would email them and say, hey, can we meet and just have a chat? But now that's what they're scared of doing. They don't want to leave that metadata trail. So instead, they're trying to figure out ways to contrive a meeting, you know, to bump into somebody, to kind of haunt to the place where the source works until they can find them in person or, you know, go to their house directly or, you know, things like that. And all of this, whether it's text stuff like encryption or air-gapped computers or whether it's meeting sources in person, all of this takes a lot longer than reporting the conventional way, and that's really slowing down the process and means much less information is reaching us as the public.
You know, people might respond to that, well, that's the way it used to be, and there was plenty of good investigative reporting that went on before the internet. But in fact, it's not just going back and using the techniques of the past. We face a very different situation here. I mean, first of all, newspapers themselves have far fewer resources to support investigative reporting than before.
No, it's true. And that is one of the things that I heard from a couple of the editors, too. They say, look, these resources are kind of scarce now. And the stories that we want to do, national security stories, intelligence stories, they're a heavier lift than they used to be. And so we have to think more carefully about how to allocate those resources. Do we want to try and take on this story? Are we able to allocate the resources to doing it? We can't, just because it's interesting, try and report it, because it takes so much time and effort to do that. And so combined with the fact that now you have sources afraid of talking about unclassified things, I don't actually think that, you know, comparisons with the past and less technology in the past really, really do justice to the situation we're facing right now.
And the other thing is that even going on by foot to meet a source is not particularly safe. I mean, if you're in a city where there are surveillance cameras, you could be picked up that way. Or through, if you go in your car and use Easy Pass, it's going to be tracked that way. You also point out that even snail mail is being photographed by the U.S. Postal Service?
Yes, apparently that's true. I mean, that's from a newspaper report. And I mean, this is exactly what the worry is. I mean, we have so much information being gathered, and we have so little detail about how it's used. And, you know, as you say, there are surveillance cameras everywhere and so forth. And this is really what the role of surveillance has come to be in this story. It's not that we know for sure that the government has used the surveillance programs to prosecute leakers or to chase down sources. What has happened is the government has already gone after sources, and now with the surveillance programs revealed to the public, we now understand the power of the government to collect information and to deploy it against us. And so the surveillance and the fact that when you enter or exit a building and scan your key card, there's a record of that. And the fact that there's a CCTV camera on the corner and all these other things, those facts become more menacing when you put them together and you realize that what you're doing is something that your employer, the government, doesn't want you to do.
You interviewed some pretty well-known reporters here. One of them is Dana Priest, who did a terrific series of reports of several years ago on mismanagement in the veterans hospitals, showing what was going on at Walter Reed Hospital and problems in veterans care. I mean, something we all would want. And she said that it's not just harder for her to do her job, but that this also makes a country less safe. What did she mean by that?
I think she meant that when you allow the government to operate in secrecy, when the government makes it so much harder for journalists to reveal information to the public, it ceases to feel the need to be accountable. And it can get away with mismanagement. It can get away with running programs that don't work as well because the public isn't able to read about it and say, listen, we don't want our money being spent that way because we don't think that's effective. We would rather do something different. And so I think, you know, her view, and her view is definitely not uncommon. I mean, a number of the journalists I spoke with say, look, it's our job to provide information to the public. And the reason we do that is so that the public can understand what the government is doing and have its say about whether the government should continue doing those things.
Now, we don't really have time to go into what the other half of the report from Human Rights Watch that you wrote, Alex Simha, with Liberty to Monitor All. That other half has to do with the impact on the legal profession. If you could just, you know, in 1 minute, basically, highlight some of the major points that the report makes having to do with the legal profession, what would they be?
The attorneys we spoke with, there are over 40 representing a variety of practice areas. But a lot of the people we spoke with who are especially concerned are defense attorneys, are very afraid about the government's collection of so much information because they have a professional responsibility to maintain confidentiality around their clients' information. And you can get sanctioned if you fail to take the proper steps to maintain confidentiality. Beyond that, clients need to be able to exchange information freely with their attorneys, and that's essential to build trust, and it's essential to develop legal strategy. And so one of the things we found was that attorneys are now feeling the need to tell their clients, hey, don't tell me about your case over email. Don't tell me over phone. Wait till I can see you in person, and let's talk about this in a way that I can be more comfortable and secure. And they're finding that that's undermining their clients' trust in the system and in them, and making it harder to be effective counselors to their clients.
So there's a proposal in the Senate. There's already been one passed by the House, which has been criticized as being fairly weak on protecting privacy from government spying. What's in the cards here for legislation, and what do you think has to happen?
So the USA Freedom Act is the bill I think you're talking about, and the House passed the weak version. The Senate's version, we are hopeful, might be able to stop the bulk collection or large-scale collection of domestic metadata, so calling records and so forth, for calls within the United States. We'd really like to see quite a few changes that would make the landscape better. One of the changes we'd like to see is exactly that, like pulling back the surveillance programs, collecting less information, including less metadata. One of the things we'd really like to see is we'd like the government to release substantially more information about how it uses the information it gathers and what it is gathering. Because without that kind of information, people are just guessing as to how to protect themselves. We also have some recommendations about reducing overclassification and protecting whistleblowers, but those are the main categories, you know, less collection, better information for the public, and better protection for us in how the information they collect gets used against us.
Well, it is a blockbuster report with Liberty to Monitor All. It can be accessed by going to Human Rights Watch. And we've been talking with the author of the report, Alex Simha. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks very much for having me.
Alex Simha trained as a lawyer. At Human Rights Watch, he works on the connection between human rights and public interest law. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.